Samaritans volunteers across Ireland took more than 56,000 calls and emails in 2020. That works out as answering a contact every 56 seconds. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to the Executive Director of Samaritans Ireland, Niall Mulligan.
Okay, it's good afternoon to the Executive Director of Samaritans Ireland, Niall Mulligan. Thank you for joining us. And Niall, you're going to be speaking about the charity's latest impact report, which was launched today. The headline, I think, a lot of papers and people are running with is that the Samaritans in Ireland answered a call for help every 56 seconds last year.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you very much for having me on. As you know, Samaritans is a primarily a telephone helpline, but we also take emails as well from people who are looking for support from us. And yes, certainly in 2020, every 56 seconds we answered a call or answered an email from the general public. So it's a huge demand on us. And I suppose one of the key things for everybody to remember is that all of our support work across the country is provided by volunteers. We have over 2,300 volunteers. So it's all done by volunteers in their spare time.
Now, Niall, we obviously know COVID-19 had an impact on the whole globe. But in terms of the charity and the organisation of Samaritans Ireland, I know you probably don't have full stats and data available at the moment. But if you are to look back on previous years, what is the difference from 2020 and now obviously going into 2021 also in terms of the amount of calls or the amount of contact you're getting? Is it more? Is it people contacting more due to COVID, or is it just that these problems are arising more because unfortunately we've more time to focus at times on the negatives, I guess?
Yeah, I mean it's a really interesting question, and there's a kind of a couple of elements to the answer. I suppose the first one is that we haven't seen a massive increase in the number of people that are calling us or getting in contact with Samaritans. What we have seen is what we would term people who have never contacted us before. So that's the first point. The second one is that people who have been using our service in the past, and even those people who are new to the service, are tending to talk for longer. So in 2020, the duration of our calls was longer, which kind of indicated to us that people were in need of more support than maybe they would normally require. And I suppose the third impact in terms of COVID on us was that it obviously had a massive impact on everybody in the country and across the globe. Particularly with the key issues that were still coming up for us, and they have always come up for us over the years, are loneliness and isolation. But they seem to have been magnified by the impact of COVID and the pandemic on people, and just sort of like the to and fro in with restrictions, etc. I suppose the other side of it is also the impact that it had on our own volunteers, because we saw a 40% decrease in the number of volunteers who were available to us over 2019 and right through 2020. And that was because of the necessity for people to cocoon and to self-isolate, especially if there were people in their own homes who were vulnerable. So that had a big impact on our service as well.
Now, a really interesting aspect of the impact report, you extended the services to the Irish diaspora living in Canada and Australia. And obviously a lot of those people might have felt homesick as is, you know, thousands of miles and kilometres away from Ireland, but not getting home anytime soon in their own heads at the time. As we know, the restrictions in particular in Australia have been very, very strict and severe. But it just shows that, you know, people everywhere are looking for help, and I guess highlights that it doesn't matter where you are in the world.
No, and I mean this is actually one of the success stories of Samaritans over the years. So even before COVID, we recognised the need to reach out, and we've done this in conjunction with the Department of Foreign Affairs to provide that service through the various embassies for people that can ring and get through to Samaritans if they need to. And we've been working behind the scenes to expand that out into Australia and Canada. And that was at the start of last year where we expanded that out. So it is a great service. I mean, it wouldn't see the same numbers as we do sort of from the general public in Ireland. But for those who use it, it is a massive support to them.
Now, on Friday, it's World Suicide Prevention Day, obviously something that's very important to Samaritans. And you are running a campaign or a theme this year, Creating Hope Through Action. What do you want to say to listeners, I guess, who have been impacted by suicide, or they themselves may have, you know, suicidal thoughts or ideations?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the key areas of Samaritan's work, that our vision is to reduce the number of suicides across the island of Ireland. And as you rightly point out, it's World Suicide Prevention Day on Friday. So the theme really from our perspective is in relation to hope and action, and actions that people can take very much, you know, sort of on an individual basis within their own lives. And they're very practical things, just in relation to helping their own health and well-being and mental health, you know, going for walks, getting involved in various activities, reaching out and talking to people if they're feeling low, and also sort of like trying to accept and understand that, you know, like how somebody's feeling at this moment in time, it can and will pass. And we have many examples of that from people who've called us over the years, who said that at a time when they have been very low and suicidal, that really what they wanted to end in their life was the pain that they were struggling with, not actually their life itself. And so it is about that hope that things do get better. And from a Samaritan's perspective, that's why we're here. You know, we're here to listen to people, irrespective of how troubled they are, that we want them to ring us, because we can help and we do help.
Yeah, and in regards to that help, you've got amazing staff and volunteers working, obviously, for Samaritans and lots of places across this world, but in Ireland in particular. And you did thank the helpline services and the volunteers for keeping the services open 24 hours a day, even at the height of the pandemic. You mentioned that up to 40% of the volunteers had to self-isolate due to a health issue or their age, and a quarter of volunteers across the 21 branches in this country remained on leave in 2021. So it's quite remarkable what was done.
Oh, listen, I can't, to be honest with you, any words that I say now are really aren't just going to be able to sum up properly exactly the effort and the contribution that our volunteers have made. I mean, people rightly self-isolated and rightly cocooned because that was government guidelines. But those who didn't need to do that really stepped up to the mark and began to do 2, 3, 4 shifts a week. And you have to remember, a lot of these people are already in full-time employment. So it was a real sort of like shoulder to the wheel effort by all of our volunteers right across the country. And they kept that service open and they kept it running 24/7. And without them, those 560,000 people who contacted us would not have had the same level of support that they have had over COVID. And we will continue to do that because that's what our volunteers do. And that's the reason why they work and are involved with Samaritans.
Yeah, and so say all of us. Definitely, Niall, words aren't enough. But I think the whole public is hugely grateful for the people who did so much work over the pandemic, and obviously in terms of charities and volunteers in particular. But if anybody is listening and they want to get some more information or want to get help, do visit the Samaritans website. It's samaritans.ie. You can call from any phone, the number 116123. That's from any phone. And you can still email jo@samaritans.ie. Niall Mulligan, the Executive Director of Samaritans Ireland, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Now, girls as young as 7 are experiencing what they described as a devastating decrease in their happiness because of online abuse. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to a member of Girl Guiding UK, 21-year-old Françoise Labaud.
It's good afternoon to Françoise Labaudet. She is an advocate for Girl Guiding UK. You're very welcome on to Kildare Focus, Françoise.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely no worries. Listen, we saw these headlines yesterday online in the papers, both here in Ireland and the UK. Girl Guiding UK warns of devastating fall in British girls' happiness as online harms rise. First, just explain to us exactly what Girl Guiding is and the poll that you've undertaken.
Yep, absolutely. Yep, so the Girls Attitude Survey, this is Girl Guiding's annual research report, which aims to capture a snapshot of girls and young women's lives, and is now in its 13th year, which is really great. And Girl Guiding asks over 2,000 girls and young women aged between 7 to 21, both inside and outside of Girl Guiding, how they feel about the specific and emerging pressures facing them today and what these mean for their happiness, well-being and opportunities in life. And the 2021 research captures the pandemic's impact and offers a snapshot of how it has influenced girls' and young women's views about themselves and the world around them.
I know you're in your 20s. I am too. And I have to say, I look at people younger than me and I just think it's so cool how times are changing and women are becoming more confident and owning their right more, I guess, is how you could word it. But there are a huge amount of girls who have experienced devastating situations like online harm. Just in the past year, 49% in the age group of 7 to 10 told yourselves that they had experienced at least one online harm over the past 12 months. So in many ways, the female experience from child to adult is getting better. But in other ways, it's obviously worse than when, we'd say, ourselves were younger.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And I think that the impact of the internet has had both a positive and a negative impact on girls within society and young women. And that's, I think, a lot of the reason for that is because of the ability to communicate with people in such a different way, and that you can, for example, receive a request from someone that you don't even know, and that can be really harmful. You can also see unrealistic and unattainable body images, and you can think that you actually have to have that perfect body in order to be kind of a person within society that has any worth. And that's obviously really damaging in terms of confidence, self-esteem and positivity.
Now, something I think that will definitely strike fear in all parents listening. This is, again, in the age group between 7 and 10. 11% said they had seen obscene pictures online. Very scary numbers there.
Absolutely. And it's shocking. And it's the access to social media and the internet which has accelerated the problem. And we at Girl Guiding call for a greater online harm legislation to ensure that young girls from 7 to 10, but in reality, actually, the whole age group from 7 to 21 are protected, and that they cannot access that particular information or have it sent to them, because that will have an extremely bad impact on them as time goes on.
And just focusing on the larger group, as you said, between the ages of 7 and 21, 71% had experienced online harm, 73% of girls aged between 11 to 16, and 91% of those aged 17 to 21. Why do you think there's such a big jump between those two age groups?
I think it's probably because as you get to the older kind of teenagehood, slash as you get kind of into your early 20s or late teens, you do access the media more and you're more exposed to it. And so I think maybe when people are younger, you know, under the ages of 15, they're not prioritizing the internet. Whereas as you get older, you're kind of using the internet on such a regular basis. And so you're more likely to face online harm or, you know, cyber stalking or unwanted sexual images because of how much time that you're spending. And also you feel pressured to actually join these kind of social media platforms because all of your friends are doing it at the same time. And so I think definitely the community that social media has kind of bred over time is kind of a key reason for the big differences in age group.
LGBTQ girls and women and disabled girls and women were more likely to experience online harm. 40% of disabled 11 to 21 year olds compared with 25% of respondents without a disability and 42% of the LGBTQI plus respondents compared with 24% of straight girls and women. Big differences there also. And if we look down a little further in terms of the survey's findings, we know that it was undertaken between March and April of this year, you know, a year into a pandemic. 67% of girls said they feel more sad, anxious or worried. Do you think the pandemic has aggravated this or increased these feelings, or has the pandemic unearthed these feelings? Did they have them previously or not?
Yeah, so looking at our girls' attitude survey throughout the years, there has been a general decline in girls' and young women's happiness. However, the pandemic has accelerated it to a level which we couldn't even comprehend. And it has definitely intensified girls' feelings of worry, anxiety and loneliness. And this, I think, is down to constantly seeing things about COVID, online, in the news, but also greater pressure being on video calls for school, and just general kind of anxiety around kind of the future and what it could hold, because a lot of people are saying that kind of this won't be the only pandemic and we're not out of the current pandemic, which I think, of course, is going to increase worry and anxiety. And that, of course, then has an impact on confidence. And that's left kind of in our age group, the 7 to 21-year-olds, like 62% of them are feeling far lonelier this past year than in previous years.
Yeah, and that 62% increases with age. And 63% said they feel happy most of the time. That's a decrease from 81% 3 years ago. So obviously the pandemic has affected everyone throughout the world. Listen, Francois Labadee of Girl Guiding UK, an advocate, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble.
Now, new research conducted by the Irish Platform for Patient Organisations, Science and Industry finds that people must be the owners of their own health data. Joined on the line to discuss this now by Chief Executive of that organisation, Derek Mitchell. Derek, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for having me.
Delighted to do so. Derek, can you outline the form of this research and why it was undertaken?
Sure. IPOSI is a patient organisation in Ireland, and we work on the basis of addressing unmet needs for patients in general in Ireland. And one of the things that patient groups and individual patients have been telling us for a number of years is around the real need to get some clarity about how health information is collected, stored and shared in Ireland. So we're interested in it for a number of aspects, and we brought together a group of individuals who are from the general public. And this was based on a model of called a citizen's jury. And the jury was designed in a way to answer questions around who do you trust to access your health information? How comfortable would you be in terms of sharing it for different types of purposes? So it was 25 people randomly selected from the general public, and they met in April of this year, and they listened to testimony from a number of witnesses, as you would in a normal kind of court-based jury, and then they made recommendations, and we've published the jury's recommendations just yesterday. And there are 6 recommendations, and they're designed to help the policymakers and the state agencies who are charged with developing policy in this space to really look at this citizen-centred approach to developing policy in health.
The trust and sharing points on which the jury adjudicated, Derek, are particularly interested and I would imagine probative, because most of us would have a certain level of trust, let's say, in our GP, because you have a relationship with that individual and you might have a vague layperson's understanding about how your health records are stored and maintained. But that concept of trust and that feeling may alter if you're referred onwards. And the sharing of data is also interesting, because it would, in technical terms, make the health service more efficient if all patient data was shared simultaneously. But then you have GDPR issues of privacy, issues of software security there. How did the citizens jury adjudicate on both of those matters?
I guess there's 2 types of information. There's information that is your personal sensitive information, and that's recognised under, as you said, the GDPR. And there are certain rights associated with that and protections in place for that. But there's another type of information that is the more what you might call de-identified information. So information that's not specific to you, but that would be useful to the health service if it was shared in a secure and an anonymized way. And currently in Ireland, we don't have a very good infrastructure to allow that sharing of information in that way. There's been a huge lack of investment in terms of the health information infrastructure in Ireland, and an awful lot of information is being collected in silos. So you have this situation where patients would appear in front of their GP, or they would have to go to a different healthcare setting or a hospital, and they have to constantly repeat themselves because that information isn't centrally stored anywhere. And there's a health risk associated with that, in that an offset of the information may be incomplete, because if you're showing up to maybe accident and emergency and you're in a distressed state, well, the healthcare professional is dependent on you to deliver that information in as complete way so that they can deliver to you the best care. So there's very much a risk around that. On the trust issue, it's very clear that there's different levels of trust depending on the types of actor that you're talking about when it comes to health information. And it's very clear that there's very high levels of trust in the Irish population for healthcare professionals, be it GPs, pharmacists, nurses. But when you get into the other kind of actors that are using this data for other types of uses, such as maybe researchers, or indeed policymakers, or indeed companies who are either contracted by the state to do a piece of work around a data set, or indeed companies looking to develop new products. So that we got in under that in our questions to the jury, and it was very interesting to see the differing levels of I think trust, but also how that trust shifted over the course of the jury process, whereby it happened over a month, and we saw shifts in what people were willing to share with certain types of actors. So for instance, when we had companies come in and talk to the jurors, we found that there was an increase in the trust once the companies were very open with the jurors in terms of how they were going to use the data. But then 2 weeks later, we found that those levels of trust had actually come back to where they were previously, because there had been certain arguments made by jurors during that course, which caused a shift. So it was really interesting as a deliberative democracy based initiative to see how certain arguments were being used and were influencing the jurors as a collective,
and how the conference upon them of information that is not ring-fenced away from the general public, but most people don't intend towards, changed and then changed again their trust.
Patients and maybe what you might call the health-interested public want to see a certain degree of sharing for not only their individual care, which makes sense from if you have to access health services, but they want to see a certain degree of sharing to improve the care of other patients. There needs to be a degree of control and agency from the individual about how that data is shared. And that was one of the main findings of the jury, that currently in Ireland, because most patients in Ireland don't actually have access to their health record in the first place. I mean, certainly speaking personally, the only access that I have to my health record is when my GP turns his screen around and allows me to see just what information is there about me. And if I actually want access to my to the rest of my record, I have to request that, and it takes about a month to come back. And sometimes we have the situation where some patients have to do a freedom of information request just to get access to their health data. So we certainly don't make it easy in Ireland access in the first place.
And I think in particular the last two points you've made, Derek, with regard to duration of time in order to receive your health data or having to issue an FOI really show that access to patient data requires a fundamental cultural and attitudinal shift within the health sector in order to enable patient empowerment in this sector, not particularly infrastructural change.
Absolutely. And if I could give a really good example of probably the only patient cohort that actually has access and has had access for many years is in the whole area of maternity care. So, and what basically happened there was that the culture shift came from the clinicians, who recognized that that women who were accessing different services were by far and away the best placed individuals to maintain their record and to bring the record to the different settings. So they had access for many years, and anybody who's been through maternity services will know that. And actually, we now have an electronic patient record within the maternity and care sector. So that's a real, change in terms of the culture that maybe pre-existed at the time. But it did happen, and it came from the healthcare professionals themselves. But I think it's safe to say that in general, healthcare professionals would be quite sensitive to the need to protect patient data, and rightly so. But I think there needs to be probably a shift, as you say, in the balance between recognizing that maybe the overly protective nature of maintaining that data, it still lies on the side of the provider rather than the citizen.
Well, Dr. Derek Mitchell, Chief Executive of IPOSI, thank you indeed for your time. Now, new data released by the National Cancer Registry of Ireland shows that there is an increasing, indeed soaring, number of people diagnosed with prostate cancer. Bernie Carter is Assistant Director of Nursing Services at the Marie Keating Foundation, and she's been speaking to Ciara Noble.
The number of people being diagnosed with prostate cancer is now higher than ever before. That's according to the latest research from the National Cancer Registry of Ireland. And joining me to discuss this is Bernie Carter, the Assistant Director of Nursing Services with the Marie Keating Foundation. Good afternoon, Bernie.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. And quite stark figures there, Bernie.
Yeah, quite stark figures. But, you know, in the Marie Keating Foundation, the last thing we want to do is alarm people. You know, our main motive is to take the fear out of cancer, make it less frightening by enlightening. Yes, we have large numbers. We've over 380 people being diagnosed every year with prostate cancer. Roughly one in six men in Ireland in their lifetime will get prostate cancer. But the good news is that the survival rates for prostate cancer is improving all the time. 92% five-year survival rate for prostate cancer if it's caught in time. So on that note, this blue September, because September is all about the men, the Marie Keating Foundation, with the kind support of Astellas, are setting up our prostate cancer campaign. It went live as in from yesterday. It's called Stand Up for Your Prostate. And in this campaign this year, we are sharing the stories of four wonderful prostate cancer survivors, Colm, Kevin, Raymond, and Thomas. And these four courageous men are sharing with the nation, with the people of Ireland, how prostate cancer has impacted their lives. And really, they've gone out there and made themselves on the forefront to ask their fellow men and those born with the prostate to take their health seriously, to go and get checked out if they're concerned at all. And on that note, what we would be recommending, because we don't have a prostate screening program in Ireland. Actually, there's not really one in the world, because we don't have anything reliable enough to create a prostate screening program. But what we do have is what's called the PSA. And this is a protein that's secreted by the prostate gland. It can be measured in the blood. This is one check that the GP can do for people born with a prostate, from once they start to turn the age of 50, but if there is a family history from the age of 45 onwards, all men, all people with a prostate should be contacting their GP and going and get checked out. This is very important. And in this campaign this year, we are supported by urology consultant Dr. David Galvin. And he would also be urging the men and the people of Ireland to go and do the same. So,
Bernie,
yes,
just to let the men of this county and further afield know, what exactly do you look out for in terms of checking your prostate? We hear a lot as women about checking your breasts. So what do men look for?
So very good question there, Ciara, and that's important. But one thing I will say, sometimes there's no symptoms. So that's why, again, we're saying for all men, from once they reach the age of 45, if there's a family history of prostate or breast cancer, they should be contacting their GP and having the chat and the discussion about their prostate health.
Bernie, for just men, to iron something out there. So even if the person born with a prostate has also a history of breast cancer, that's
exactly
included. Okay, very interesting. Okay,
and you picked up on that one, which is great, Ciara, because we will talk about that. But what we'll talk about first maybe is get to that question about what to look out for if there are symptoms. So that prostate gland surrounds the tube, the pipeworks that brings the urine to the outside. It surrounds the neck of the bladder. As men age and beyond the age of 50, that gland starts to increase in size. And this is a natural process of aging. But it can also increase in size if it's cancer, or it can increase in size if there's inflammation. So what it can do, if it's increasing in size and squeezing on that tube that brings the urine to the outside, it will cause problems with passing urine. It may be that the person is getting going more often during the day, getting up more often at nighttime. Maybe they're having problems passing urine. It might be that they're slow to get started. It might be that there's a change in the flow. It might be more weaker than usual. Maybe it starts off good, then it slows down, then it gets good again. So any change in the flow whatsoever, it may be that they need to go and they got to go now. So it's urgency. You got to go. You got to go now. Might be in less common symptoms, we might see blood in the urine or blood in the semen, or it may be that the person feels that they're not emptying their bladder after they've been to the toilet. Now, I have to say, Ciara, that these also could be signs of an infection in the prostate gland, of inflammation. It could be just a natural increase in the size of gland, the natural process of aging that's causing this problem. So don't be afraid, but do go and get checked out, just to be sure, to be sure. And the GP will maintain the person's dignity in checking the person out, because what they may also and most likely would do is do what's called a digital rectal examination. So as well as taking that blood test to check the PSA, the GP most likely would do a digital rectal examination. And I know a lot of people go, my God, yuck, I don't want to have that done. Us women, people with the cervix, have to have our routine cervical screens done. Similar, the digital rectal examination takes less than 5 minutes, and it can give the GP such valuable information about the prostate gland and give the GP the information to know, should I refer this person on via our rapid access clinics in Ireland to see a urologist? Should I just treat this person for an infection and bring them back and repeat the PSA and repeat the digital rectal examination? Now, on the note of the PSA, it's good, but it's not brilliant. And it's important to say that. It is, again, a blood test. It's a blood test to check the levels of that protein produced by the prostate gland. And the levels do go up with the natural process of aging. But the levels, this PSA can be unreliable in that sometimes the levels are high and the person gets a bit of a scare and there's nothing wrong. It might be an infection, again, as I just mentioned. What I will say on that note, for any individual going to get their PSA done, it's very important not to exercise strenuously or to ejaculate for 48 hours before going, because this can cause a change in the PSA and you get a false positive or a false scare when there's no need to. So again, the PSA can go up for no reason. It can go up if there is cancer. It can go up if there's an infection. Sometimes there can be cancer there and it doesn't go up at all.
Okay.
So even though it's all we have, it's not the most reliable. And so a person should not be scared by the numbers. Further tests need to be done to rule out, is this cancer or is it not? And that's very important. And that's why I would say for all people listening, go to the Marie Keating Foundation, mariekeating.ie. Go in and have a look at our campaign of this year and listen to the stories of those four wonderful men telling how they found their cancer, how they found their prostate cancer, what their journey was like, and go in and look at the symptoms and do a little review. But please don't ignore a symptom. A symptom is the body telling us something ain't right. And that old stitch in time does save nine.
Yes, yes. And Bernie, we obviously know earlier this week the famous singer Sarah Harding of Girls Aloud died of breast cancer, very sadly on
very,
Sunday.
Very sad.
She was only 39 years
old.
Far
too young to leave this world.
Yes, absolutely. But you did mention there that people born with a prostate, if they have a history not only of prostate cancer in their family, but also breast cancer, they should keep an eye out for that. Just explain the connection there, Bernie.
Yeah. Of course I will, and there is a link. So there are risk factors for all cancer. Having a risk factor doesn't mean a person is going to get a cancer. It just means that chances might be higher. So one of the risk factors for prostate cancer is if, first of all, if there's a family history. So you're 2.5 times more likely to get prostate cancer if your father or your brother had it. The risk increased with age. So if you're a person over the age of 50 with a prostate, then there is an increased risk. Inherited genes. And like you said there, Kira, breast. If there's breast cancer in the family, if there's breast and prostate in one side of the family, if there's possibly breast and prostate and even ovarian in one side of the family, alarm bells may go off. Is there a mutation, a gene, a faulty gene in this family? So the gene we'll be talking about here is the BRCA gene, BR for breast, CA for cancer. A lot of people know it as the Angelina Jolie gene because Angelina Jolie did test positive for a mutation in this gene. I have to say mutation because we all have those BRCA genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2. They're there to protect us from cancer, but they can change and become faulty. And a person with the prostate who may have a faulty BRCA2 gene has an increased risk for prostate cancer. So that's very important to know. So knowing the family history is very important, that risk of prostate, if prostate and breast is in the family. And then if there is that risk from the age of 45 onwards, having a chat with the GP about your prostate health. And the GP will take it from there as to what to do.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble speaking indeed to Bernie Carter of the Marie Keating Foundation.